Welcome to the Second Court of Appeals this afternoon, and good afternoon. We have one oral argument scheduled, and that's yours, and then we will adjourn and go into conference on other cases that are set for submission without argument this afternoon. I keep wanting to say this morning. If y'all are ready to get started, I'll ask the clerk to call the case. Ready? Okay. Okay, Mr. Wide, are you ready to proceed? Yes.
May it please this honorable court. It's a privilege to be back in front of Judge Gabriel. I had the privilege of appearing before her several times up in Denton County when she was a trial court judge, and I don't believe I've been before Justice Sutterth or yourself, Justice Gardner. Yeah,
I apologize, I didn't introduce us.
That's okay. I'm just grateful you've got nameplates in front of you so I don't have to rely on my memory on who's on the panel. This is my second oral argument in the last 6 months before this esteemed court. And if you keep treating me this well, I'm going to keep coming back.
Okay.
So that having been said, I remember where I was standing when the light went off in my head about what an appellate court really, 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 really wants. I'm not here to tell you what the law is. You have all the briefing attorneys and people that, and you know the law. What I'm here to do is to walk you through where I believe the trial court simply erred in looking at what was before the trial court and what's in the record before you, and then to point out why that is quote-unquote reversible error, if you will.
And can you jump right to the jurisdictional question?
Yes.
Because Appellee raises that, and I want to hear why you think we've got jurisdiction.
Well, you have jurisdiction because if you look in the clerk's record, the appeal was filed, if you will, on April 22nd, 2015. And Justice, the trial court has never even issued findings of fact and conclusions of law in this case, even though proper and timely requests for findings of fact and conclusions of law were made, as well as a notice of late findings of fact and conclusions of law. So if you didn't think you had quote-unquote jurisdiction, you obviously can remand to the trial court to have them file their findings of fact and conclusions of law. But under the TRAP rules, any time a receivership is ordered, if you will, and there's only two provisions that I'm aware of, and I could be wrong or mistaken, of course, where you can have a receivership. One is under the Texas Family Code, if you will, but that is only in cases of divorce, and that's Rule 6.05. Ultimately, the court has to have jurisdiction over not only all the parties but all the property to have a receivership under Rule 6.05. And that's when it's setting, obviously, temporary orders, which I'm sure you're more than eminently familiar with. The other provision for a receivership is under Civil Practice and Remedies Code, Section 64. And that's a much onerous, much more heavy burden to have a receivership. Again, going to the jurisdictional issue.
Aren't you really arguing the July 2nd, 2013 order? Isn't that really what you're complaining about? Because that's what was reinstated in April of 2015.
Yes.
And so wasn't it incumbent upon your client to raise the appellate issues germane to the July 2nd, 2013 order back in 2013 and not in 2015?
And the answer is yes and no.
Okay.
Yes, because he's entitled to someone is entitled to an interlocutory order. No, because until there's a final order in a court, we would have avoided basically an intermediate appeal and then back down to the trial court before we even had a final order. So once there's a final judgment, as you know, then either through motions for new trial, notice of appeal, so on and so forth, the trial court's jurisdiction wasn't vested yet at that point in time until notice of appeal was filed. We also moved in the record, I apologize, Justice Gardner, but...
Until you moved filed the notice?
Yes, until we filed a notice of appeal. If you'll notice in the record, we actually requested that there was an order requesting release of the receivership. And you also note from the record, Justice Sutter, that you've read clearly that we had the appellant in this case had, with regard to the receivership, contested it, so to speak. So
they agreed to it in the Rule 11 agreement and in the agreed order back in July of 2013.
Actually, he agreed to deposit funds into the registry of the court pursuant to a Rule 11, and I would suggest to you at that point in time the issue was moot. If I could point out something to you, he did not agree. Respectfully, I would like to think that I could agree to disagree with you without being unreasonable. But I would like to point out something to you that's of imminent importance in the record of this case. If you will look at the reporter's record, Volume 3, Father's Exhibit Number 3 is a copy of the Attorney General of Texas Child Support Division Financial Activity Report. As of December 3rd of 2012, the appellant in this case had a credit. He owed no child support and had paid more than $6,656.68 over what he had been ordered to by the trial court. In addition,
does that relate to any of your issues? You're not attacking the sufficiency of the evidence in the trial court's finding that he had failed to comply with the order by payment of child support. So how does that go to any of the issues that you've raised?
Because the issue of a receivership or the setting aside of any property at that point in time becomes moot because of the onerous nature that the if you will, the movement of the receivership has. The movement has the burden to show why the receivership, which is absolutely crucial.
Well, the Rule 11 agreement said that if once he complied with everything that was ordered or everything he agreed to in the Rule 11 agreement, mm-hmm. that she would be responsible for immediately releasing any encumbrance yes. she had on the property, so forth and so on. Did he ever ask her to do that, or are you just asking us to just assume that magically this all went away because you say you had a credit?
Well, what I'm saying is that from a legal point of view, it becomes a moot issue at that point in time. I was not his attorney when he entered into the Rule 11. I've only been the appellant's legal counsel. Let me establish my alibi if I can. You know I'm not over. I don't take myself too seriously. I take these proceedings with the utmost seriousness. But let me establish that I was not his trial counsel at the time. I was retained. Our firm was retained to handle basically the receivership and appellate issues, if you will.
Well, may I ask a question? Is this appeal regarding the receivership and property, is it an interlocutory appeal, or are you considering an appeal from a final judgment?
No, I'm considering an appeal from a final judgment. And that choice, whether to appeal interlocutory or to appeal, wait for until you have a final judgment that vests this court with that authority, that was the point in waiting at this point in time. To wait till there was a final resolution of all the issues so we could take care of everything at one time.
Okay, and that's when?
That's now.
Okay.
Yes. In my humble opinion, Your Honor.
Well, if let's just say hypothetically your client complied with everything that was ordered in the trial court's order that encompassed the Rule 11 agreement, then and Ms. Rooker released the encumbrances, that would have been a final order, wouldn't it?
I really don't know, to be quite honest with you, because of the procedural aspects going back and forth were, you know, again, I wasn't involved in it at that point in time.
I know, but we weren't either. So we have to take what we're given and look at it. So why wouldn't it have been a final order? What else would there have been for the court to do at that point in time? If he had done everything that he was supposed to do, it would have been done and over.
I agree with you in that regard. And, you know, if he had a credit on his child support payments pursuant to what's in the clerk's record, as well as not owing any, he had a zero balance on his medical support, then I'm not able to explain to you how this receivership issue was still viable or still alive, if you will, prior to beginning of January of 2013 in these proceedings. Nonetheless, as you know, and your opinion is part of the record on the contempt issue, okay, he was held in contempt for not complying with those things. I'm not here to, by any means, educate or lecture you on Spates, which you know out of the 14th Court of Appeals, which relies on Anderson and Dell Court, the two U.S. Texas Supreme Court decisions. I think you know and I know that the proper due process procedural aspects of having somebody move show cause to be held in contempt and ultimately be held in contempt, that was not complied with. So your opinion is obviously cited, which, you know, I would be remiss if I didn't bring that out in this situation, if you will, this panel. The next part of why this is not, why the trial court basically committed error and ultimately reversible error is that not only can the trial court not order a receivership because there's no divorce, there's not a common law marriage, the trial court has no in rem jurisdiction over Mr. Hernandez's current wife's separate property. That's another problem in
this
case.
Well, how can you argue her rights in this court? If your argument doesn't belong to your client, then how can you assert her rights here today?
Well, she should have been joined as a party by the...
Isn't that her issue, not your client's issue?
No, respectfully, yes and no again. The appellee should have joined her as a party once the appellee got notice that Mr. Hernandez, that other people had a vested interest
right.
in the property.
But assuming that's true, assuming they should have joined her, mm-hmm. the failure to join her is not your client's issue. It's your client's wife's issue.
But it also goes to whether or not the trial court had quote-unquote jurisdiction, which is the issue you brought to me. And the trial court has to have not only in personam and subject matter jurisdiction, but it had no in rem jurisdiction over these entirely over these properties.
But at the time that the properties were placed into receivership, I haven't seen anything wherein you have argued that they did not belong to Mr. Hernandez at that time, which was back in 2013.
Included in the reporter's records, if you will, is the fact that he was, quote, married. And then, of course, at that point, there'd be the presumption that this court must follow that if he's married at the time and not former spouse in any way, shape, or form to Appalee, but because he was never married to the appellee, he's just the father, which is why it's a SAPSR. But if Mr. Hernandez was married at that time, then the appellee would clearly be on notice, and the trial court would be, that would be presumed under Texas law to be community property.
And maybe he shouldn't have entered into the Rule 11 agreement the property was going to the receiver.
If you're willing to find in my favor, I'm more than happy to agree with that statement.
I don't see how those are consistent.
Well, let's not lose the forest through the trees, if you will. Isn't the ultimate purpose of all of this to make sure that the child support payments were in fact made? I mean, isn't that the point, was to guarantee that the child support payments that the court had previously ordered were supposed to be made? Whether he complied with the Rule 11 agreements or not, whether or not those things become kind of a mute, a rabbit trail or side issues, when in fact, by December 3rd of 2012, the appellant had done everything by law he was required to do. And then ultimately, this receivership gets ordered, and I'm going to suggest to you that it's not just to guarantee child support payments, but there are some reasonable inferences when you're talking about liquidating someone's property, if you will, appointing, obviously, a receiver, liquidating property in order to pay attorney's fees to a large extent, which were also ordered in this case. And
$4,000 was ordered in this order. There was $218,000 in child support. I don't That's not a large extent of $218,000.
The ordering of, I agree with that, and the ordering of attorney's fees, if you will, that's not all the attorney's fees that were being argued about in this case. The only issue on appeal with regarding to attorney's fees is whether or not the appellee pled for those in the contempt proceedings or the contempt documents that they had filed. Ms. Moore did not plead for those, and therefore what's not pled for cannot be granted by a court, if you will, as a general rule of thumb.
But back to the real property.
Yes.
And who owned it? At the time that a Rule 11 agreement was entered into, one of the things the father agreed to do, which apparently he didn't do.
Yes.
But you correct me if I'm wrong, was to execute the documents to perfect a security interest in the Calmont West Haven Drive and West Haven Drive property to secure payment of child support. And apparently he instead transferred those properties to his wife.
Well, he transferred them to a limited liability company, MDS Investments LLC, of which his wife has some, I take it, ownership interest in, if not all.
Wasn't that in direct violation of the court's order that he could not encumber those properties?
I don't have her order in front of me, but I would be inclined to agree with you, if you will. Hence, that's why you go back to court and you file the proper motion for enforcement. You have to file a motion for show cause for contempt. The proper due process proceedings have to be followed. And let me articulate to you why. It seems when you have when somebody can be ordered held in jail for up to 180 days without a jury trial under Texas contempt law, basically, you and I both know that's equivalent to a Class B misdemeanor in the state of Texas. But you don't have law enforcement filing a case with a district attorney's office or a prosecuting agency. In that type of situation, you have usually a private attorney, in this case, Ms. Moore, filing a motion with the court for enforcement and or to show cause. You have that person coming before the court, if you will, and there's been absolutely no... The term I would suggest to you is the checks and balances that are available for due process protections that you have in the criminal justice system versus in the civil side. That's why with obviously Delcourt and Anderson and Spates, they make it so painful for trial courts to actually hold people in contempt, because the due process rights must be guaranteed, and you don't have those guarantees on the civil side in family and civil court like you do in a county criminal court or a court that has criminal jurisdiction.
Except that the commitment order has to be very specific.
The judgment,
and so forth.
Yes, Your Honor, absolutely. And that's what Spates, Anderson, and Delcourt all say, basically, that it's not only that those things have to be specific, there's a certain order that they must be done in. You must have a judgment of contempt. Then you must have the order of commitment. Now, when you can see that the trial court was not pleased with your ruling, Justice Gabriel, on January 27th of 2015, if you will, when Ms. Moore, just a few days later on January 27th, after the appellant was released, in the clerk's record, I would point out to you on January 27th, 2015, page 55 of the clerk's record, this is crucial. Ms. Moore submitted a motion to sign an order holding respondent in contempt and granting judgment. Well, that violates Spaeth, Delcourt, and Anderson.
Excuse me, counsel. Your time is up.
Yes, Your Honor.
You reserve the rest for rebuttal.
Yes, Your
Please.
Honor.
Okay. Thank you. Ms. Moore? Counsel?
We are here specifically because of the April 2nd, 2015 order is what the appeal is allegedly on. But the appeal is basically of a decision signed and rendered on July 2nd, 2013. The issues were all determined Mr. Hernandez had an opportunity to appeal at that time. He did not appeal. The idea that we're going to blame some former attorney, I can tell you I've been on the case forever, Stephen King, relatively well known in family law. Judge Navarez was not on the bench at that time. He tried this case. Michael Tresider from Coons Fuller was the one who eventually worked out the Rule 11. This case, the order of April 2nd only does away with the suspension of the receivership.
Did the suspension have anything to do with the finality of the July order?
Absolutely not, Your Honor. We have, in family law, we have orders all the time where our courts retain continuing exclusive jurisdiction. We order child support is paid for years into the future. That doesn't mean it's not a final order. It is absolutely a final order.
And now, I understand that appointing a receiver wouldn't mean it's not a final order either, but I guess my question is whether the agreed suspension of the appointment of the receiver would affect the finality.
I don't believe so, because I think that the issue is, so long as they made an agreement, the receivership is not going to go into place. That was already ordered, and it wasn't appealed. So what we did was we made an agreement that so long as you do all of these things, as we do in many cases in family courts, the receivership will not be enacted. When he did not follow the orders of the court, because the agreement became an order of the court when it was incorporated into the order, the Rule 11. So we have an appeal, issues 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and 9 are all specifically in question of the 2013 order. That's all they are, because they say the trial court failed in its obligation because it ordered a receivership. It didn't order a receivership in 2015. It ordered a receivership in 2013. So as far as I'm concerned, those can't be a part and parcel of the appeal here today. Now,
what about the attorney's fees? Did you plead for them? Did you put on any proof?
Yes, Your Honor. The appellant misunderstands the award of attorney's fees. The award of attorney's fees were granted under 157, and it's not that the court may, it is that the court shall. If the court finds contempt, then the court shall enter an order for attorney's fees, reasonable and necessary attorney's fees. In the motion for enforcement, attorney's fees were pled for. They were proven up at the hearing, and they were granted. Now, what Mr. Wide refers to is attorney's fees for the motion to enter the order. And I will admit that I did not file a pleading asking for attorney's fees on that motion to enter. My bad. And I was not allowed to put on any evidence about attorney's fees for the cost of the motion to enter, the motion to sign. But the attorney's fees had already been ordered prior.
The $4,000?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay.
Those had already been ordered at the finding of contempt. When the order for the suspension of the receivership order was revoked, those two things were heard at the same time. The motion to revoke the suspension and the enforcement. Those were both heard at the same time. And the
It was one motion, wasn't it?
It was one motion, but they were combined. I would say that as to the attorney's fees, it's not just a possibility, it's a shall. I would say that for 157 says, if the court finds that respondent has failed to make child support payments, the court shall order respondent to pay movement's reasonable attorney's fees and all court costs in addition to the arrearages.
What was that, 157?
167A.
167A. Okay.
Now, I am a little confused about the findings of facts and conclusions of law, because I saw that in his appeal. I assumed that it was an oversight or something, but I have a copy of the findings of facts and conclusions of law signed by Judge Wells, and I had my staff print one today from the file at the courthouse. So I know that the findings of facts and conclusions of law were signed and filed by Judge Wells. I'm not sure.
What's the date of that?
The date is December 22nd, 2015.
Okay, so you didn't ask that there be, that the record be supplemented, though? Would that be correct?
I did not.
Okay.
In my opinion, this appeal is a shaded attempt to bootstrap onto an appeal that they have decided was not filed at the time that it should have been. Clearly, any appeal of the appointment of the receiver, of the sale of the properties, this order was issued by Judge Wells after a full and very comprehensive trial of the issues in the case. The order for a receiver to sell was not under Civil Practice and Remedies Code, under 157.323. The court can use many remedies, and receiver is one of them. In particular, although I don't believe it's an issue here today, I don't believe it's ripe for appeal, 157.326 deals with the interest of an obligor's spouse or another person having an ownership interest. Quite frankly, this case is on stall, because until this is determined, there's no way for my client to ask for either a finding by the trial court that the transfer of property from Mr. Hernandez to his wife was either fraudulent or certainly against the order of the court from July 2nd, 2013. But until this issue is resolved, we can't go forward. At that time, there may be a necessity to bring in Mr. Hernandez's wife or his daughters or any of the number of other relatives that were involved when Judge Wells heard this case originally, beginning in 2012 and finally in 2013.
Well, did you plead fraudulent transfer in your pleadings in the trial court in this case?
Not in this. All I asked for was a suspension of the receivership.
I mean, when it
back
was
then,
to be
no,
reinstated.
Because they hadn't been transferred at that time, you see. They were transferred post his agreement, Rule 11, and post the entry of the July 2nd, 2013 order.
So are we possibly missing an issue that is necessary to determine, or a party that's necessary to be added that might affect the finality of the judgment?
I don't believe so, Your Honor, because the April 2nd, 2016 order, and I'm not really sure about why he thinks that Judge Wells was upset with your order, because her order wasn't signed until April 2nd. When the habeas corpus was filed, the appellee did not pursue continued incarceration. I mean, that was not an intention. I'm sure that you all see that all the time, but there was no... Once the habeas corpus issued, the due process question is gone. Spates, Anderson, and Delacorte deal with commitment, not with an order finding someone in contempt, establishing arrearages, and ordering child support. They don't have anything to do with that. The issue of whether or not Mrs. Hernandez may have an interest can be determined by the trial court. But it's not here today. It wasn't an issue to be heard by the court. It wasn't ripe for hearing at the time that we filed for an enforcement and Revoke. To revoke the suspension of the receivership. It may be ripe, but again, the Family Code provides a specific procedure through which we address that. We can't appeal what happened in 2013, in 2015, by saying, oh, there was a subsequent order, so we're going to go back to that. Mr. Hernandez was found in contempt for failure to pay child support as ordered. Now, there are, I don't know how many times you all play with the child support records from the AG, but those are notorious for problematic situations. The fact is, the issue was tried to the judge. Mr. Hernandez had representation. He had a full hearing. His due process was not abrogated in any way. You all, this court, released Mr. Hernandez on December 19th. You issued a judgment vacating the commitment on January 22nd, I believe. The judge entered an order, and in appellant's brief, it specifically misquotes one particular part, because it says,
what page?
Page 22 of appellant's brief. It says, he claimed the trial court stated, and I quote, I'm just going to add in the sentence that it is therefore ordered that the respondent has to fulfill the punishment ordered by the court. In fact, what the trial court said was exactly the opposite. What Judge Wells stated was, I'm just going to add in the sentence that it is therefore ordered that the respondent has fulfilled the punishment ordered by the court. There was no additional commitment. There never intended to be. If there had been an additional commitment, you all would have gotten another habeas corpus. You didn't. My client didn't seek continued incarceration. There was no reason for it. And Judge Wells did not order it again. There was no breach of his due process rights at all. This court found that the commitment order, not supported by the underlying contempt order, was not satisfactory for his continued incarceration. You found that. You did not find that the order by Judge Wells for failure to pay child support was void. You did not find that he was not in contempt of the order. You did not find that the award of a judgment was improper, and you did not find that the award of attorney's fees was improper. The only thing that the Spates, Anderson, Delacorte would support are the commitment issue, and the commitment issue is gone and was gone even before the entry of this order, because it's never been addressed again. Judge Wells didn't address it. My client didn't address it. I didn't address it. So the commitment is really, in my opinion, it's the veil that allows the appellant to try and bootstrap to the July 2nd, 2013 order. I see that I'm about out of time. I can answer any questions if you have any. Thank you.
I believe we have no questions. Thank you very much. And now we can have rebuttal.
I had hoped to waive, but I would like to bring out to you once again, in the index, in the clerk's record, on page 55, is a motion to sign order holding respondent in contempt and granting judgment on January 27, 2015. I don't understand that argument about how they were not still pursuing contempt when 5 days after Justice Gabriel had issued her opinion, there's an order in the clerk's, a motion in the clerk's record.
Well, there's a difference between holding someone in contempt and ordering that they go to jail.
That I understand. On there's an order holding respondent in contempt and granting judgment on page 69 in the clerk's record, dated April 2nd, 2015. Whether or not a commitment order was issued or not, I'm not arguing about. But
you actually say twice in your brief, on page 22 and page 23, that a new commitment order was signed on April 2nd, 2015. You say that twice in your brief. Can you show me in that index that you have there where that order is, the new commitment order that you say twice is there?
I don't have that entry into in the clerk's record. What that probably was meant to reference, if you want to know, is that a judgment was granted at that point in time. But once a judgment is granted, then the court has the discretion to obviously issue the commitment order. I don't know whether Judge Wells issued a commitment order or not. It would have hopefully been stayed by purposes of an appeal, which we were, you know, planning on. But I would like to go back and address
briefly.
Wait a minute,
before you do that, did you misquote the judge on page 22 of your brief?
Justice, I'm not the author of the brief, to be quite honest with you. That's was authored by an associate of mine. But secondly, I don't have the reporter's record before me regarding what Judge Wells.
Well, certainly I can look it up. I just didn't know if you.
It says what Ms. Moore says it says, because I read it this morning, and I also read that once the judge said, I'm going to write this in there and resolve this issue, is there anything else on this? Trial counsel did not object anymore, did not pursue their due process objection anymore, but moved on to the motion to vacate. Well, so didn't, at that point in time, didn't they waive any further issue?
I don't know if there's any waiver or not, Your Honor, but obviously if the trial court did not pursue incarceration, then the contempt issue at that point in time would be moot. So, you know, nobody's going to scream and bloody start filing applications for writs of habeas corpus with yourself or even the trial court if obviously there's not going to be a commitment, a physical commitment. So, I get that. The issue before you is not just what, which is about child support, but how, which is the receivership issue. And with all due respect, the courts are bound by the law, and you can have a receivership under 6.502 with temporary orders. But if you look at the language, it says while a suit for dissolution of marriage is pending, that means the trial court must have jurisdiction over both the parties and the property, which it would obviously have in a suit for dissolution of a marriage.
What does it say right after that?
This is 6.5.
And on the motion of a party or on the court's own motion after notice and hearing, the court may render an appropriate order.
Is that the Civil Practices and Remedies Code or the Family Code that you
No, Your Honor, the Family Code.
Okay.
So under our argument, if you will, and I'm sure as you understand, but then you go to Section 154, which we have cited extensively, about how the manner of payment, how do you intend the court order child support, okay? So a receivership is outside the trial court's jurisdiction unless there's a dissolution of a marriage suit pending. That's one. Two, the payment, the manner of payment talks about the setting aside of property, 154.003, number four, the setting aside of property. The court can order property be set aside, obviously, as well as the lump sum payment, the periodic payments, the annuity, so on and so forth. But the plain language of both those statutes limits the trial court in ordering liquidation of property. And I would suggest to you that ordering liquidation is way beyond setting aside. Administering of the property is way beyond setting is not equal to liquidation.
What is your best case authority for your position that a family court cannot order property sold to pay child support?
I would argue the plain language of those two statutes.
I'm asking for your best case.
Edgemeyer is probably the seminal case in its progeny from 1977, where the Texas Supreme Court dealt with the separate property, and that was the separate property of a husband and a wife. And we cited Edgemeyer, and if you'll give me a minute, I'll let you.
I can find it.
Yes,
thank
well,
you.
Not that, but I'll also like to point out to you on that issue, besides Edgemeyer, if you will, the trial court can order property to be set aside, just like she can order the Rule 11, the property, the money deposited in the court's registry. But if the if the obligor makes those payments, then and then the money in the registry should not be forfeited per se. In other words, you can put money in the registry of a court, or property can be ordered to be set aside under 154, but it cannot be liquidated. And that's what Judge Wells ordered in this case. And the only way you can do that is through Chapter 64 of the Texas Civil Practice and Remedies Code. And to do that, the preeminent condition precedent to Chapter 64 is insolvency. To have a receivership, you must prove insolvency. And that was never proven in this case. Thank you so much for your time. It was always a pleasure and a privilege to be here in Fort Worth. Thank you very much for granting oral argument.
Thank you, Mr. Dade. Thank you, Ms. Moore. And I'm sorry, I have the name written down. Pierce. Thank you all. Excellent briefs and good oral arguments. Very interesting, unusual case. Your case is submitted and you're released, and we will adjourn for the day.